This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. As a felony prosecutor, Lane Cook saw all kinds of cases. Drug sales, robberies, burglaries. But there was one case that stood out to her when she took the job back in 2006.
It's very rare that we have a young person who is being so scary.
This is a good time to tell you that this episode is not appropriate for young kids and other sensitive listeners. Anyway, Chad Absher, the defendant in this case, was just 20 years old, and he'd already had a distinctive tattoo inked on his chest.
I'm all about tattoos, but getting a tattoo of a clown with a pistol at such a young age.
Chad had been dating a teenager who was still in high school in Jacksonville, Florida, where they both lived. They'd known each other since she was in the fourth grade. The couple had been seeing each other for about a year when she broke up with him. Chad wasn't taking the rejection well.
He had been consistently stalking her for the last couple of weeks since their separation, following her at her home, school, work.
If you know anything about dating violence, I don't have to tell you that just after a breakup can be a really dangerous time. And Chad's behavior was growing more dramatic. The young woman's mother saw him cut off the head of a teddy bear and leave it in the driveway. Then he put the decapitated body of the stuffed animal next to the teen's car at school. Chad just wouldn't leave his ex alone. He'd call her several times a day, at all hours, saying things like, "If I can't have you, no one else will."
He threatened to kill her if she ever left him, and even wrote her a letter confirming those threats.
So she reported Chad to the police for stalking. And then he did something a lot scarier than mutilating a teddy bear.
Everyone in the home was lucky to not have been hurt.
It was 2:30 a.m., early in the morning of February 25th, 2006, and a neighbor heard loud music blasting from a Chevy Blazer in front of the teen's house. The neighbor recognized Chad and chased him away. But Chad came back and fired seven shots into his ex-girlfriend's house with a handgun.
Three of the shots entered the victim's room, and the other four were scattered throughout the home. That is just terrifying.
The police collected five bullet casings from the house, and that wasn't the only evidence. Pieces of metal from Chad's Chevy had fallen off in the street, but Chad had gotten away. In the terrifying days to come, the teen's family moved her to another location for her safety as she sought a protection order against Chad. Still, the threatening phone calls didn't stop. "If you continue to get the police involved, I will continue to shoot up your house," said one. And just days after the shooting, when her mom went to pick her up from high school, they saw Chad, and he started following them. They lost him and called the police again. With a warrant out for his arrest, finally, Chad turned himself in. When Chad's case came Lane's way, she knew she had a strong one.
There was a massive amount of incriminating evidence against him, which for me is a relief because I don't have that fear that he could get away with this.
The teen, her family, the neighbor, they'd done everything right as far as Lane was concerned, talking to the police multiple times, seeking a protection order.
Ultimately, I would say the system worked at that time.
Chad pleaded guilty to shooting or throwing deadly missiles and aggravated stalking. He was sentenced to 4 years in prison. The goal was to keep him from committing more crimes.
Trying to keep him from turning into a hardened criminal. I think that's something that was on all of our minds because of his youth.
With the case behind her, Lane felt not just relief for the family whose lives Chad threatened, but maybe even a little hopeful for him.
My last memory of the case is thinking this young person still has a chance to change their life around.
I grew up in Jacksonville and was living there back in 2006 when all this went down, and I didn't hear anything about Chad's case at the time. Gun violence between intimate partners is just so common in the United States. Every 16 hours in this country, a woman is shot and killed by her intimate partner. Women are 5 times more likely to be murdered when their abusers are gun owners. So, should a young man who is convicted of shooting up a house full of people when his girlfriend dumps him ever be armed again? Our gun laws say the answer is no.
Today we begin to disarm the criminal and the careless and the insane and all of our people who are deeply concerned in this country about law and order should hail this day.
That's President Lyndon Johnson when he was about to sign the Gun Control Act of 1968. It was spurred by the assassinations of President John F. Kennedy, Senator Robert Kennedy, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. That law bars convicted felons like Chad from possessing firearms forever. It's been on the books for decades. And since then, federal law and some state laws have gone even further to try to keep abusers from owning guns. Even some people convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence are now prohibited from owning firearms. So are people who are under protective orders. Even with all the fighting about guns in this country, this is one thing our gun laws forbid. I wish I could tell you that the only gun Chad ever touched again was the pistol tattooed on his chest held by the clown. But that's not what happened. Reveal's Jennifer Gollin takes it from here.
I'm sitting on the covered front porch of Lisa Rucker's home in Jacksonville. It's June and the weather can't decide what to do. It's raining off and on.
All my friends at work told me that I should do a podcast.
The pandemic's still raging, so we're sitting outside. Everything is green and lush, with moss hanging off the trees. Lisa's telling me about the day that she met Chad.
We were just kind of letting the kids run around, play in the yard. And across the street was this guy.
Lisa and her older sister Ashley were both single moms, bringing up young sons. And they spent a lot of time together with their boys. In April 2014, they were at their grandmother's house for her birthday.
A couple of kids were out there with him, some little girls, and he was on a lawnmower, like taking the kids on a ride on the riding lawnmower.
That looked pretty fun to Ashley's son, Joseph.
Joseph goes over and starts playing with the little girls, and he's asking if he can get on the lawnmower. He wants a ride.
Lisa and Ashley walk across the street and strike up a conversation with the man driving the mower. Chad ran his own lawn care business after his release from prison.
He's a nice-looking man. He's got his own business. He seems to have his stuff together. She doesn't know the real details of why he went to prison. And I don't think specifically she cared at that point. You know, she saw him at face value, basically.
A couple of weeks after they met, Ashley went on her first date with Chad. I ask Lisa about Ashley.
Ashley's always been very, very headstrong. I've always been kind of a pushover. So it went hand in hand for a majority of our lives. If she ever did anything wrong, like when we were little, if I did it too, then I couldn't tell on her. And I was always right there with her, like, oh, are we gonna run across the street and go to so-and-so's house even though we're not supposed to cross the street? Oh yeah, we're gonna go and you're gonna go too. I'm like.
Ashley worked in healthcare. First in a call center, then as a medical assistant. She was hardworking and tough, the kind of person who protects other people, including her younger sister.
If you were her friend, she had your back 100%. That's just who she was. When I was younger, she used to tell me that I would never have to fight anybody because she would always do it. And to this day, I'm 32 and I've never been in a fight in my life.
By 2015, Chad and Ashley were living together. But before long, Lisa saw trouble.
What was your first clue that something was wrong?
Okay, so I got a phone call from Chad, and he said, your sister's going crazy. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he says, we were arguing and going back and forth, and she stabbed herself in the stomach. And I was like, what do you mean she stabbed herself in the stomach? You got to call the ambulance. Why are you calling me? Call 911.
Police records show that an officer was dispatched just after 11 p.m. for a suicide attempt. But by the time the police arrived, Ashley was gone. Chad told police she'd run away and was wearing a camouflage shirt and blue jeans. The police put out a missing person report. Here's how it described her. White, female, 28 years old, 5'4", 120 pounds, brown hair, blue eyes. Within hours, police found her. Ashley had made it fewer than 7 miles away. She was lying on the floor in the back of her car in the parking lot of a nearby Comfort Suites hotel. There was a deep cut in her lower abdomen. She needed to see a doctor right away.
I got a phone call telling me that she was in the hospital, and they said that she was placed under security measures because she was telling them that she did it to herself.
But as doctors examined Ashley, this idea that she tried to kill herself, it fell apart.
The doctor basically said to me that it's almost physically impossible for you to stab yourself through your abdominal wall. That the knife had gone so far that they weren't sure if she had punctured any organs, so she was going into emergency surgery.
It became clear to Lisa that the doctors weren't concerned about protecting Ashley from herself. In fact, they even had her registered under a fake name. They were trying to shield her from the person who had stabbed her.
I was the only person that was allowed to come in and see her. My father was not allowed in. Nobody was, because they said that what she was saying happened could not have happened. So somebody had to have done it to her.
When Ashley got out of the hospital, she went to stay with her dad for a while. But eventually, she and Chad got back together.
Anytime Ashley was doing whatever Chad wanted her to do, things were good. Everything was great.
Until it wasn't. Then there would be a blow-up, sometimes involving the police. She'd go and stay with her dad again.
It just seemed like a never-ending cycle. I didn't really know what to do. You could tell that she was really controlled. There were times where, you know, we'd all be in the car together and the air was heavy. It's just like you didn't feel right even speaking because you just felt like an argument was going to start.
And sometimes when Ashley and Chad fought, he pulled out a gun.
She told me that he hit her in the head with a gun.
Remember, it was illegal for Chad to possess a gun under federal and state law. And Ashley didn't just tell her sister about Chad's gun, she told police.
In early 2017, there were police reports that were made that he possessed a firearm and threatened my sister with it.
I got copies of these police reports through a public records request to the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. They show that Jacksonville officers responded to a domestic battery call. Ashley had scratches across her face, and she told officers that Chad had a rifle, and then he said, I'm going to die for you. The report notes that Chad is in possession of a firearm, weapon, or ammunition by a convicted Florida felon. It's right there in black and white. The officers knew that Chad was prohibited from owning a firearm. If convicted, that's an offense that could have put him away for up to 15 years. All this doesn't sit right with Lisa.
Why was no one, no probation officer, no city official, no one from the judicial system or police officers, no one decided to say, hey, this is a convicted felon and it's reported that he has a weapon. So why don't we just go and, you know, search their house, get a warrant, search their house. Let's find it, take it. Let's get it back.
As we heard, the reason Chad couldn't own a firearm is that he'd shot up his ex-girlfriend's house after she broke up with him. That ex had escaped Chad. Now Ashley was trying to get away.
Was she afraid of him?
I believe she was, but she was a fighter. She was that way her whole life. She never backed down, never. she was always gonna fight back.
When we come back, Lisa tries to stand up for her sister.
There's an altercation. I'm asking someone to leave. They will not get out of my apartment.
That's next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Support for Reveal comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/reveal. That's odoo.com/reveal. Odoo, modern management made simple.
This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. A network of anti-democratic groups are attacking these freedoms, seeking to force us all to live by their narrow beliefs. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/MJ.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. This hour, we're talking about domestic violence and guns. And I should mention, this episode is definitely not for young children and other sensitive listeners. When we left off, Ashley Rucker was trying to get away from her boyfriend, Chad Abshire. And in 2017, it seemed like she might be succeeding. Reveal's Jennifer Garland picks up Ashley's story.
It was summer in Jacksonville, and Ashley was trying to make a fresh start, away from Chad.
She got her tattoo that had Chad's name covered up.
That's her sister Lisa Rucker. And this time, instead of going to stay with her father, Ashley turned to Lisa.
Because anytime I was around, he would never put his hands on her.
Ashley thought that being near Lisa would help protect her from Chad, so the two sisters moved into a condo with their young sons.
When Ashley and I moved in together, she had told me that she was going to try to break things off with him. But every time that she would say, like, I can't do this anymore, I'm done, he would threaten her. I heard him tell her that he would kill her and all of her family.
People often wonder, why don't domestic violence victims just leave their partners? You're hearing one of the major reasons why. Researchers have found that fleeing a violent relationship can be very risky. But to Lisa, it seemed like Chad was just trying to intimidate Ashley.
Do you think it's just a threat? Do you think he's just mad, angry, saying mean, hateful, hurtful things? It seems kind of silly to compare it to this, but it's like, you know, unicorns are nice and they're pretty, but you don't think you'll ever really see one.
And what happened on October 30th, 2017, is something that Lisa never imagined she'd see. It's Monday night at the condo. Lisa and Ashley get pizza for their sons for dinner. Lisa's new boyfriend is there, a guy named Lyle Scheidman, and Chad's there too. But Chad and Ashley are arguing. One of those arguments that sounds pretty mundane at first.
I heard my sister say to Chad, where are my car keys? And he said, I gave them back to you. And she said, no, you didn't. So they went back and forth with the car keys for hours.
Ashley really loves this car, a black Mercedes.
Every time he stuck his hand in his pocket and said, I don't have your keys, she could hear it
jingling in his pocket.
So she kept telling him that, you know, give me my car keys, get out of my house. You know, I have to go to work tomorrow. Please give me my car keys.
This is all happening while Ashley is trying to break up with Chad, but he's having trouble letting go and keeps coming around to the apartment. Now he's holding her car key hostage, trying to control her. Finally, Ashley walks up behind Chad and plucks her car key right out of his jacket pocket. And Lisa thinks that the drama is basically over for the night.
Ashley has her car keys. We've already told him to leave multiple times. I figured he's either A, gonna leave, or B, go lay down and go to sleep.
So Lisa goes into her own room to watch a DVD with Lyle and chill out.
And I sit down at the end of my bed and I'm eating my pizza. My nephew comes, Joseph, comes running into my room and he says, T is Chad's nickname. He said, T's choking my mommy. He won't let her go.
Lisa and Lyle rush into Ashley's room. They see Chad lying on the bed with one arm around Ashley's neck.
He's got like this arm underneath her neck area and he's like this on the bed. So he could have easily went like this or this.
As she says this, Lisa pantomimes choking with her arm. Now Lyle starts to get into it with Chad.
And Lyle says, so you're going to put your hands on a woman? And as soon as he says that, my sister jumps up out of the bed, runs out the room. Chad gets up. He takes off his necklace, takes off his shirt. And he was like, I ain't put my hands on nobody yet.
Lisa can see where this is going. Nowhere good.
And so, all right, so y'all are going to start fighting. I looked at Chad and I told him that I was calling the police. Any other time I called the cops, he would just leave.
On the beginning of the 911 call, you can hear a voice yelling, get off the phone. Then Lisa starts talking.
Get off the phone. There's an altercation. I'm asking someone to leave. They will not get out of my apartment.
Okay, who is that, your boyfriend, your brother?
No, it's my sister's boyfriend. It was my sister.
Gotcha.
She's asking him to leave. We're both asking him to leave.
Okay,
he won't leave.
Ma'am. Okay, ma'am, thank you.
The part where I feel like I really messed up is the dispatcher asked me,
does anyone have any weapons, any drinking or drugs involved?
I just said no.
No.
Even though I knew he had been drinking. I didn't know there was a gun there. But I said no simply because any other time, he would just leave just by the simple act of me dialing 911.
All right, we'll send the next available officer out there. Call us back if anything changes, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, bye-bye.
I hung up the phone, I looked at Chad, and I said, the cops are on their way. And as soon as I said that, he pushed me.
That was the breaking point. Lyle and Chad start fighting, and it's getting pretty violent. Punches thrown, shelves breaking. Ashley and Lisa are standing back, out of the way. Their sons are in Lisa's bedroom. But then Ashley tells Lisa this fight needs to end because Chad has a gun.
My sister says, stop him, he's got a gun. And I didn't know if she meant on him or what. So I told Ashley, I was like, how am I supposed to break up two grown men fighting? So she comes over and she grabs one shoulder of Lyle's. I grab the other shoulder and we pull him back off of Chad.
Lyle goes outside, and Lisa sees that Chad's pretty beat up. His face is cut, and there's blood all over the place. Ashley keeps telling him to leave while he paces around the condo.
I wanted the cops to be able to see the scene and see what happened, but I didn't want the boys to come out and see the blood.
So Lisa starts cleaning up the mess from the fight. Ashley's helping, too.
I stopped at the linen closet. My sister and I were separating the stuff that had blood on it and didn't have blood on it. Chad walks past me and rubs his bloody face in my hair. And I scream at the top of my lungs, get out of my fucking house, you know, as loud as I can.
That doesn't work. Lisa goes back to wiping blood off the floor. Then
He pulls out a rifle from behind the chair cushion and he points it at me. As he's pointing it right at me, he says, "So that's how it is, Lisa?" And as I'm looking at him, every part of me was like, he's not really gonna shoot me. You know, he's upset. He's just trying to scare me. That was my exact thought as I turned my head away from him. And as I turned my head down, it was bing, everything went black.
It's now early Halloween morning, and a neighbor calls 911.
Jackson 911, what is the location of the emergency?
Hi, I'm not sure. I believe somebody up in my apartment just got shot.
Okay, I need to, what's the apartment complex?
Cedar Creek Landing.
Okay. Was it a male or female?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
My ears started ringing, and it was like I was inside my own head. I could see my entire body, and it was pitch black. Everything was black. I can see my entire body, and out of like what would have been my peripheral vision, I saw this perfect circle of bluish white light, and I heard a loud noise.
To this day, Lisa doesn't know if that noise was a gunshot or Ashley screaming.
When I came to the first time, Ashley was about 6 feet away from me. I couldn't tell where she was shot. I just saw blood around her head.
To Lisa, it doesn't look like Ashley has lost that much blood compared to her. And since she's still alive, she figures Ashley must be okay.
The first thing I thought was, she's fine. I thought, she's okay, she's okay. She's just out when I'm in when I'm out. That's what I thought, and that's what I believed.
But the neighbor talking to the 911 dispatcher is panicking.
He shot him in the head.
In the head? Okay.
Oh my gosh. Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ.
The neighbor is right. Both Ashley and Lisa have been shot in the head. Lisa's still going in and out of consciousness, and she wakes up to see Lyle standing over her. And he's on the phone. He's talking to 911 too.
Hello.
Oh my God, there's been a murder. There's been a murder. Oh my God.
The kids are crying. The dispatcher is trying to get the address, but Lyle doesn't know it. He and Lisa haven't known each other that long.
What's the address?
I don't even know the address.
Come on, give me where you are. What's the two? In the street.
Give me the two. Baby, are you okay? Baby, are you okay? The address is on. What's the address? I don't know the address.
Put someone on the phone.
He shot him in the head. I'm over here at the apartment. Oh my God. Oh my God.
I thought that was it. I thought that he just killed me. I thought that I wasn't going to see my son grow up.
And Lisa's nephew, Joseph, and her son, Colton, are there, witnessing all of this. They are just 9 and 4 years old.
The third time that I came to, I looked over and I saw Joseph standing over my sister, my nephew standing over my sister. And he was crying. And I guess Colton noticed that I was awake because he came over to me and he said, "Mommy, please don't die." And he probably couldn't understand me, but I just said, "I'm okay, baby, I'm okay, I'm okay." I knew I was far from okay. I was just trying to say whatever I thought I could to calm him down.
Police soon arrive. Chad has already fled. Ashley is pronounced dead at the scene. Lisa is rushed to the hospital. At this point, it's not clear that she'll make it. In the ambulance.
I remember them telling me that they were going to take my dying declaration because I had lost so much blood and because of the extent of my injuries. They asked me if I knew who shot me, and I said, yes, T, Chad Absher. They asked me again. I said the same thing, and I went completely out.
Chad has since been indicted for murder and attempted murder. We reached out to him in jail and through his lawyer, but he didn't respond. But there's one more charge that Chad is facing. It's the least serious, but the one that holds the key to how this whole tragedy could have been prevented. The third charge, possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. That's because Chad had been convicted for shooting up an ex-girlfriend's house and stalking her. Under federal and Florida law, it was illegal for him to have a gun. And Ashley had told police he had one just 6 months before.
In early 2017, there were police reports that were made that he possessed a firearm and threatened my sister with it.
But officers didn't get a search warrant to see if Chad really did have a gun. So when prosecutors looked at the case, they had only Ashley's word to go on. And they said Ashley wasn't answering their calls or their voicemails. Domestic violence victims are often reluctant to cooperate with prosecutors. The state attorney's office concluded that there was insufficient evidence, so they declined to prosecute. We wanted to know more about why officers didn't get a search warrant and why Chad wasn't prosecuted. But the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office refused to be interviewed for our story, as did the state attorney. Only now is Chad being prosecuted for having a gun. But it's too late for Ashley Rucker.
Do more than just take the report, you know? I feel like had that been done in early 2017, my sister would still be here. I wouldn't have to live with the trauma, the scars, the heartache, and everything that goes along with it. I wouldn't have to live with it. My nephew would still have his mother.
This problem goes far beyond one death in Florida. I spent 8 months looking into cases like this one in more than 20 states, combing through court records and police reports. I took domestic violence homicide data and ran criminal background checks on hundreds of perpetrators who gunned down their intimate partners. I found more than 110 intimate partners and others who have been killed by people using guns they were federally prohibited from having. That was just over a recent 4-year period in 21 states, so that total is likely a vast undercount. They include factory workers, nurses, and waitresses. Among the dead were police officers, bystanders, and more than 10 children. More than half of the victims were people of color. Some of the offenders killed themselves after shooting their partners. Others have since been convicted for these homicides. And then there are those like Chad Absher, who are still facing charges.
All of those deaths could have been prevented if laws we already have were actually enforced.
We shouldn't have laws in the books that are just for show.
When we come back, Jennifer Garland uncovers why so many convicted offenders still have guns. But first, I want to tell you about a series I've been working on. Next week, we're launching a new 7-part reveal investigation. It's a story about a black teenager who died during a traffic stop with a white deputy in rural Mississippi. I've been carrying this story around with me for a decade because it reminds me of growing up as a black kid in the South. It's about Mississippi, but also about how justice looks different for different people. Be sure to tune in next week for the launch of this series. You're listening to Reveal. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. This week, we're investigating domestic violence and guns.
He found my apartment and he put a gun to me.
After years of decline, the number of people gunned down by their intimate partners has jumped 58% over the last decade. And women make up the majority of victims. Reveal uncovered dozens of cases of convicted offenders, people who couldn't legally have guns, who went on to shoot and kill anyway, their partners, children, sometimes even bystanders. We found cases in Alabama, Ohio, Arizona.
Hi, I have a missing employee.
When was the last time you saw the employee?
Last time I saw them was Tuesday.
Federal law in some states prohibit felons and many people convicted of domestic violence from having firearms. But they often don't explain how those guns are supposed to get handed over. So those laws often simply aren't being enforced, like this case.
The gun that night, you said in your email that it was on his hip.
The reality is, our gun laws make it pretty easy in most places to keep firearms you shouldn't have and even get new ones. But it's clear law enforcement and lawmakers could be doing a lot more to prevent these deaths.
We did not know that the police had given him that gun back, and I didn't know the laws anyway.
And then there's the case in Jacksonville that reveals Jennifer Gaulin has been digging into. She takes it from here.
To the people who knew Chad Apsher, it wasn't exactly a secret that he had a gun.
He always had a gun on him. Like, anytime they came to the house, he would have his gun and put it on my refrigerator and, like, let it be known that he had it.
That's Tiffany Johnson, who also lives in Jacksonville. Her best friend was Ashley Rucker, who Chad is charged with murdering.
Never really thought much of it because he didn't seem like, you know, like he was going to use it or anything. He just always acted like a man and carried a gun.
The police also knew he had a gun, even though he wasn't supposed to. Ashley had told them 6 months before she died, but he wasn't prosecuted for it. The state attorney's office concluded there wasn't enough evidence because Ashley was the only witness and she wouldn't talk with them. Of course, the irony is that the state attorney's office is now prosecuting Chad for the very same offense, possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. Both federal and state law barred Chad from having a gun, yet he and so many others still have guns illegally. So I went to Washington, D.C. to see what the feds are doing about getting guns away from convicted offenders. I met with Thomas Chittum.
So you're from West Virginia?
I am.
Okay.
Can you just tell from listening to me talk?
No, I read your bio.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
He's the acting deputy director of the chief federal agency that fights violent gun crime, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, or the ATF. Their job is to investigate firearms traffickers and people who illegally possess guns. I came to the ATF with our findings about abusers and guns, all those preventable deaths. But it turned out I didn't have to convince Chittum that there's a problem.
How do we ensure that people who have become prohibited don't continue to retain firearms? The so-called honor system, where people who are now prohibited because of domestic violence convictions or subject to restraining orders, divesting themselves of firearms that they currently possess. That has been a challenge.
It's an honor system because federal laws don't spell out how offenders should surrender their firearms. Basically, the system trusts that people will do the right thing.
How many people are prohibited from having guns because of felony convictions and qualifying domestic violence misdemeanors?
Oh, I don't know that number. I'm not sure anyone knows that number with precision.
How many domestic violence homicides are being committed by people who are not allowed to have guns?
I don't have that number.
So you don't know how many people have died at the hands of partners who were prohibited possessors, and we don't know how many prohibited possessors are out there?
I think that there are probably reliable statistics on how many domestic violence homicides occur, and I'm sure the number is high and too high. But as to the specifics, I don't know them.
You heard that right. The federal agency that enforces the nation's gun laws has no idea how many offenders are barred by federal law from having firearms. They don't even track how many intimate partners they've killed with these guns, and neither does any other federal agency. Getting guns out of the hands of known abusers who aren't supposed to have them, too often it happens too late.
The challenge with domestic violence is it often occurs behind closed doors. The first time the firearm is used to commit violence, it is tragic, and it makes it more difficult for us to detect.
Local jurisdictions like the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office could notify the ATF if they think a convicted felon like Chad Apsher has a gun and is breaking federal law. We wanted to ask the Sheriff's Office if they did that back in April 2017, when Ashley Rucker told police he had a gun. But the sheriff wouldn't agree to an interview. When the ATF gets a tip like this, they can arrest offenders and pursue federal prosecution. But the agency has about the same number of staff as a medium-sized police department, and none of its agents specialize in domestic violence.
So it doesn't sound like the ATF has any specific personnel dedicated to just domestic violence cases. Is that right?
No, that's right. Our personnel are dedicated to investigating federal firearms violations writ large.
The reality is the ATF is caught up in America's culture wars over guns. The National Rifle Association has aggressively lobbied Congress to limit the ATF's ability to regulate firearms. Since 2006, the ATF has had only one permanent director, which makes it harder to get more funding and staff. The agency has about the same number of employees as it did a decade ago. And last month, the Biden administration's nominee for director tanked after the NRA opposed his confirmation. The administration scrapped David Chipman's nomination after key senators withdrew their support.
It's always tough being the ATF. We serve as a convenient symbol for a divisive issue, but the reality is the men and women of ATF do a tremendous job.
But we've had these federal gun laws on the books for decades to try to curb domestic violence with guns.
What more should the ATF be doing to go after abusers with guns?
I think we do a good job of focusing the limited resources that we have to bring to bear on a wide range of federal firearms violations.
Is there more, do you think, the agency should be doing?
Well, we can always do a better job, and we don't ever miss an opportunity to improve.
But women like Ashley and Lisa Rucker are still being shot. And no federal agency is tracking how many abusers who aren't supposed to have guns are killing their partners with them. That makes it hard to prove anything more needs to be done about the problem.
It's quite mind-boggling.
That's Shawnee Buggs, an assistant professor at the Violence Prevention Research Program at UC Davis Health. For researchers like her, who study gun violence as a public health issue, the lack of data goes with the territory.
The lack of tracking for the number of people who are prohibited is just one of many startling things that are not currently tracked. We don't know how many people are shot but do not die from firearms in our country. We can only estimate. We do not know how many firearms are actually purchased.
There's no national gun registry in the U.S., which makes it difficult to know exactly how many guns anyone has. And federal law and some states allow private gun transfers without background checks. That makes it easy for offenders to get a new gun, even if they're barred from doing so. But Buggs says the lack of good data is no excuse for not taking action to protect victims from prohibited offenders.
We know enough today that we do not have to wait for more information to act. However, it is critical that we get more information so that we can truly understand the scope and the nature of the problem.
Of course, these federal gun laws that are only sporadically enforced, it's Congress that created them. And if they're not working, Congress can change them too. So I headed to Capitol Hill.
How are you guys doing?
How are you?
I'm good.
It's so nice to meet you.
Same here.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your time.
Of course. Thanks for caring about this issue.
Congressman Eric Swalwell is a Democrat from California. He's also a former prosecutor who understands the challenges of getting convicted abusers to give up their guns.
Right now, it's the Wild West as far as guns in the hands of abusers.
He told me just hoping abusers will tell the truth about their guns is not enough.
So the honor system is essentially you go to court, you're arraigned, you're advised that if you have firearms in the home, you have to give them up. And you have to disclose which firearms you have. But again, you are trusting somebody who is not worthy of being taken at their word to just be upfront and shoot straight with you about firearms they have in the home. And that has been to the peril of domestic violence victims.
Swalwell has proposed legislation he calls the No Guns for Abusers Act. It would require the federal government to develop procedures for abusers to relinquish their guns.
If we do nothing, if we allow the current system to exist, we are sending a message to perpetrators that you can unlawfully keep guns and that we're not going to be willing to do anything to take them from you.
The legislation has already died in Congress twice. He reintroduced it earlier this year, but it's unlikely to pass.
We shouldn't have laws on the books that are just for show. If we don't have a mechanism to actually get the firearms out of the home.
The nation's landmark law to protect victims of domestic abuse is called the Violence Against Women Act. It's now up for reauthorization, but the latest version is all carrot and no stick when it comes to relinquishment. It would help fund programs to take guns away from abusers. But communities aren't required to create these programs. It's all voluntary. That bill is still pending in the Senate. But what if we didn't just rely on the honor system? To Lisa Rucker, it's not that hard to imagine a better way. For starters, someone could actually try to get the guns out of the hands of abusers who aren't supposed to have them.
Someone who takes specifically those reports and goes and follows up. A whole department. You can make one in every major city, kind of like a probation officer. Just check.
In some places around the country, relinquishment is starting to happen. In Dallas, Texas, in Denver, Colorado, and in Seattle, King County, Washington. So I called David Martin, a prosecutor in Seattle, who helped create the program there.
I've had to sit with families who have lost loved ones, the firearms, and it's something that never leaves you.
And he knows what it's like to live in an abusive home.
As a kid who got to witness his mother be a victim of domestic violence, I remember the police coming to my home and then, like, nothing happening. Eventually, my mom was able to get away, and my sisters and I went with her. But I always thought and expected something terrible would happen.
Before the new program, he says, Seattle, like most places, just trusted offenders to get rid of their prohibited firearms.
It was an honor system. There was no mechanism that you would check to really make sure that people had done what they were supposed to do. There was no system of accountability.
Under the new law, police responding to a domestic violence incident temporarily remove weapons. Plus, domestic violence offenders who are subject to protection orders must surrender their guns. And in King County, a domestic violence firearms enforcement unit helps make sure that happens. All of this is the result of a decades-long effort by community advocates, prosecutors, and statewide gun safety groups to protect victims of intimate partner violence.
It's probably the most important thing that we're doing right now. Removing lethal means from people is the best way to keep everybody safe.
Firearms coordinators review cases and interview victims to learn more about prohibited firearms an abuser may have. And when law enforcement moves in to remove the weapons, it's often less dramatic than you might expect.
There was a belief from our law enforcement partners, you're like, wow, it's so high risk and it's so dangerous, we're going to have to send a SWAT team each and every time to take guns from these very dangerous people. But most of the time, it's law enforcement connecting with people who are really low point in their life and saying, like, hey, this is what's happening legally. And I want you to understand that we need you to surrender your weapons. Right? To do so in a way that doesn't belittle or demean people, doesn't embarrass them, and instead recognizes that they're going through a lot.
But in most of the country, we're still operating on the honor system, and the cost of families is high. On Halloween 2017, when Lisa Rucker was shot in the head, the bullet nicked her carotid artery and shattered the bone on the left side of her face. She was in a coma for 2 days and underwent at least 6 surgeries. Lisa still bears the physical scars of that night, but it's the emotional scars that are the hardest part for her and her son, Colton. The shooting killed Lisa's sister, Ashley, but it tore even the surviving members of her family apart.
I miss my nephew so much. I just wonder, like, how does he feel? Does he think that we just, like, abandoned him?
Since the shooting, Lisa says she's only seen her nephew, Joseph, 3 times. Both Lisa's nephew and her son were in the condo when their mothers were shot in the head. After that night, Joseph's dad took him to live out of state. And Lisa's son, Colton,
he's withdrawn. He used to be just open. Like, if you knew him before and know him now, you could tell the difference. He always tells me how much he misses my sister and Joseph, my nephew. It's hard. And I can only imagine, you know, as a child, seeing the things he saw, that he won't be able to really process what he went through correctly. And I'm worried that it will stick with him forever. You know, they say children are resilient, but they're not supposed to see that. They're not supposed to go through that.
No one is keeping track of the number of offenders who are prohibited from having firearms who've killed their partners. Reveal has compiled data from more than 20 states, but we know there are more cases out there. We're going to continue looking into intimate partner shootings by people barred from having guns. If you know someone who's experienced this type of violence, we'd love to hear from you. Text GUNS to 474747. Standard data rates apply, and you can text STOP at any time. That's GUNS to 474747. Reveal also partnered with Al Jazeera English's documentary program, Fault Lines, to produce a film on this investigation. Unrelinquished will premiere at the Double Exposure Film Festival starting October 13th. It will be available on YouTube and Al Jazeera's website on October 20th. Our lead producer for this week's show is Catherine Miskowski. Taki Telenidis edited the show. Special thanks to Amina Wahid, Layla Al-Aryan, and Joel Van Herren from Fault Lines, and Reveal's Nina Martin and Amanda Pike. Also, thanks to Nader Zucchino, Catherine Seifer, Grace Oldham, and Esther Kaplan. Victoria Baranetsky is our general counsel. Our production manager is Amy the Great Mustafa. Original score and sound design by the dynamic duo, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. They had help this week from Stephen Rascon, Claire C. Note Mullen, and Brett Simpson. Our digital producer is Sarah Merck. Our interim CEO is Annie Schabel. Sumi Agarwal is our interim editor-in-chief. And our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camerato, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Hellman Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the In As Much Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.